Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Amas podcast. I'm your guest, Gabriella Love. Thank you so much to all of you who have been supportive so far and sharing this far and wide. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Today we have an amazing guest with us, Cicely Blaine. So I looked up Cicely and I've read so much, learned so much, and I am excited, so incredibly excited for you to get to meet them as well. Cicely, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the Almas podcast, and please feel free to take a moment or two to introduce yourself.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here. My name is Cicely Bell Blaine. My pronouns are they, them. An equity and inclusion consultant, CEO and writer based in Vancouver on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, originally from the UK.
Beauty. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's start with the consulting firm. I've noticed that the name was recently changed. What's the story behind that?
When I started the company in 2018, I just was feeling uncreative, so I just named it after myself. That worked for a period of time. I had sort of established myself as a writer and activist and public speaker, so people were Googling my name. They would come across my business. But what I sort of found was as my team grew and there were so many other people offering services with me, people still sort of had the expectation that they would get me and only me. So I wanted, and that, you know, that also started to have an impact on my mental health and just like how much I could disconnect and switch off because the business and me were one entity. The new name, Bacow, it's a place in the Gambia, which is where my maternal family is from. It's a beautiful coastal town. Yeah, I just wanted like a nice sort of one word, sort of bold name for it, sort of represent the journey we've been on and represent how far we've come, and also allow me to not necessarily take a step back, but allow me to kind of be a little bit more behind the scenes.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Beautiful. There's something that you said that I'd love to hear a little more about. The part about disconnecting and being able to switch off. Like I imagine just kind of looking at what's out there online about you, one might assume that there's a lot going on in your life and that you've got a lot of plates that you're kind of juggling. So what is that like for you? How do you switch off and why is that important?
Yeah, things are definitely busy. And I think especially over the past year, I know everybody has struggled with Zoom fatigue, for example. That's just been so present in my life, you know, 15 to 20 Zoom calls a week, and it was just getting really exhausting. And I wanted to get to this place, which I'm almost there, where I'm doing more sort of behind the scenes work. I'm growing the business. You know, I'm dreaming up visions for the business. I'm spending more time focusing internally and looking after my team, trying to meet their needs, because a lot of the work I do can be quite reactive. You know, people are reaching out as a reaction to an issue. And so that makes everything feel very urgent and very overwhelming. And I wanted to get to a place where I could find that joy in the work again. And it was, I felt where I can feel less called upon, less at the whim of others, less just sort of take back control essentially of myself, of my identity, of my time. Yeah. So that's kind of what disconnecting means for me is, you know, I want to focus on my writing more and that requires a bit of quiet. And, you know, I was recently writing about my experience with ADHD and for me to get writing done, you know, I don't like to have my day sort of broken up by thousands of meetings. For me, that's sort of what that's meant.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's so interesting. So recently I met someone who has ADHD or identifies as having that. And they've been encouraging me to kind of explore it a bit more to see if maybe I fit the description as well. I'm curious to hear what that journey has been like for you now that you've brought that up.
Yeah, it's been a long road. And I think especially during the pandemic, really kind of really just trying to understand a lot of the things I was experiencing, especially as a teenager and in university. Just wondering why, when I'd always sort of grown up being told I was so clever, I was so smart, I was so hardworking, but at the same time felt like I was struggling so much to meet deadlines and do things on time and focus and all of these things. And that just kind of, those two things felt very at odds. And I think that's why a lot of people who are raised as girls especially are underdiagnosed, because they may be seen to cope more, but I think a lot of that is survival mechanisms, you know, sort of developing the ability to multitask or to mask your symptoms. And so I think over the past year, I've really had this pivotal moment of realizing that actually I don't have to, you know, struggle with those things and I'm not defective or deficient in any way, rather that there is a very real thing going on in my brain, which might be different from other folks. And yeah, just first self-diagnosing, but then also getting an official diagnosis and being able to get medication has really helped me.
That's absolutely great. Have you found, like, have you been having conversations around this with other folks? And how have you found those conversations happening?
It's been really fascinating, actually, because one, you know, the first thing my doctor said to me was, oh, adult ADHD, especially in non-cis men, is extremely rare. And I was sort of taken aback by that because so many people are talking about this and, you know, resonating. And recently I made a couple of posts and wrote an article about my journey with ADHD and just like hundreds of people just reaching out and saying they've experienced very similar things and also very similar experiences of being dismissed or being shut down when they speak about their potential ADHD. So it's just really fascinating to me how a lot of doctors seem to think and a lot of the quote unquote research seems to suggest that it's extremely rare. But I then started to wonder, is it rare or is it just missed, you know, that it's just underdiagnosed? So that's been really interesting. It's nice to know how many people resonated with what I shared, but also, yeah, kind of alarming to see how many people have struggled with those things and haven't had access to support and have been shut down or misdiagnosed or, yeah, all of these things.
I'm also very surprised at hearing that. I actually just assumed based on how often I've seen this word used and how often people say that they've experienced certain symptoms that are very, very much spot on. That doesn't seem to match that at all. That's very interesting. So now I'm curious. So in your line of work, which maybe you can tell us a bit about that so people actually have an idea, because I do, but people probably don't. Some people don't. In your line of work, what sort of parallel to that have you found? Like, what are some key areas that you've noticed have just been missed? And it's not that they weren't a thing, they just were missed.
Yeah, I guess to tell you more about my work. So we at BackOw offer a range of services. I would say our primary or sort of most requested service is our workshops. And we offer a lot of training for all kinds of people, all kinds of industries, anything under the umbrella of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we try to do that from an anti-oppressive lens, which means we encourage people to recognize systemic oppression and recognize how that's showing up in functioning academic or professional spaces. We also do other things like auditing clients from a DEI lens. So that means doing an investigation or exploration into how are people feeling? What's the working environment? How is power functioning? Is there toxic leadership? Is there a lack of representation? So yeah, that's kind of the work we do. And that particular service, our auditing service, yeah, does illuminate a lot of really interesting things where, exactly as you say, people may say that that's not a problem or, you know, we don't have that issue here. But oftentimes we discover they very much do have that issue. And, you know, I think especially when it comes to DEI, there's been a lot of, I guess you could say, like there's been a lot of Band-Aid solutions, but not enough structural change. So on the surface, people may perceive that an organization is inclusive. An organization may even promote or market themselves as being inclusive. But then when we dig deeper, we see that women and people of color are still being underpaid, or non-binary and trans people are being misgendered or don't have a safe place to go to the bathroom, or the leadership team is still all white men. Yeah, very similarly to my experience with ADHD, there's this sort of bias that I think there's oftentimes a bias among leaders that they've got it all figured out. And just because nobody's reporting something, they assume that means there's no issues, without realizing that potentially the reason people aren't reporting things is because there are issues and they feel unsafe coming forward, or they don't know how to bring things up. It's interesting to see that and to give people a bit of a reality check sometimes.
I'm curious. In my experience, I've often looked at certain organizations. I think if we take, for example, a large corporation that's been around for 150 years or something like that, it is like, this is my perspective, it is a lot harder to make those changes on a structural level. It's just organizationally, it's not built in that way. And so you really have to go back to the building blocks and change things there. And I just find that such a challenging problem to tackle. How do you tackle that?
That's a great point. It's really challenging. I would say that's the big question is, you know, sometimes how do you get to the root? I think it depends on the industry or the organization. If we were to look at something like policing, for example, it is reform possible? I don't know. I don't think so. it sometimes trying to get to that root is almost impossible. And we have to start questioning, does this structure, this system, this entity need to exist? Can it be reformed in the way that it currently looks? Most organizations we work with, obviously, we feel a bit more hopeful about the potential for change. Mm-hmm. Trying to go deep to look at the historical sort of actions of the system at large, as well as that organization specifically, like, you know, when it comes to education and thinking about how education has been used as a tool of violence and harm, especially towards Indigenous people in North America. And how do we reconcile that in the present day? And how do we educate teachers, for example, to use that knowledge in a responsible way, you know, to recognize the ongoing legacies of how that system may have harmed people or did harm people, and the legacies and the intergenerational trauma of that continues potentially for their current students. It's definitely difficult. And sometimes it does require, you know, something drastic, something radical, like, you know, the removal of a toxic leader or the complete restructuring of an organization or sort of pay equity, for example, like things that take time and money. And that's where we've had the most success with clients, when they're really willing to go deep and they're willing to commit to a long-term process.
So when you partner up with various organizations or work with clients, what are some factors that you'd look for to determine for yourself whether or not that willingness is there and that willingness is genuine?
Well, we definitely try to understand what work has already been done. If we have a client come to us and it's centering around a specific issue, that's usually a red flag. Like if, you know, if a client comes to us and they're trying to problem solve something sort of drastic, or, you know, where somebody's been hurt or there's a lawsuit or something like that, that's usually a red flag for us, because it's a very reactive response. Usually we find that, you know, clients who are being proactive, who are interested in this work because they know that it's important and valuable, and they see the long-term power of that, that's usually a good sign for us. And there's, of course, other factors like budget. With nonprofits, of course, you know, budget can be limited, but I think especially with corporate clients, the money is there. It's just, are they willing to invest in a long-term process? And that's also something that we factor in as well, because we don't want to get, you know, halfway through a process and then suddenly they say, we don't want to invest any more money in this, and we've kind of started a relationship with them, but they're not willing to see it through. I don't think that hasn't really happened, unless it is, you know, a genuine budgetary constraint. It's just interesting to see. And I think over the past year, especially, there's been quite a shift in how many clients are interested in that long-term work, rather than simply the sort of performative or tokenistic things, you know, like a 1-hour lunch and learn, which I think still has value, but it's not going to transform any systems. So yeah, it's just interesting to see that shift as well.
It seems like the conversation has really shifted in the mainstream, specifically, unfortunately, because of various events that happened in 2020. What was that like for you, the year of 2020? I know that first of all, you founded Black Lives Matter Vancouver, the Vancouver chapter. I assume that you were probably far more involved than I was, for sure. But what was 2020 like for you? Because I can definitely say for myself, it was horrifying, confusing, upsetting. I was angry all the time. And just a lot of anger. It was also a very transformative year for me. So I'm curious, yeah, what was that like for you?
Mainly exhausting. I just think, yeah, I mean, obviously it was already a pandemic. And I think one of the most complicated feelings for me is, going into the pandemic, my work was previously almost entirely in person, you know, relied on large events. I did a lot of public speaking workshops. And so I was like, okay, well, is my business going to survive this pandemic? And then suddenly, yeah, white people woke up to the reality of racism. And it just felt so bizarre, because the murder of George Floyd, although tragic, was not the first nor the last, or even the first of its kind. You know, people like Eric Garner were murdered in a similar way. It almost felt random. It was very hard to understand why suddenly, aside from the pandemic, meaning that people were on their phones more, or maybe were paying attention to social issues more. But the randomness of it was really jarring. And when you've been sort of shouting into a void for so long, and obviously, you know, Black activists before me have been shouting into that void for even longer. Yeah, suddenly people care. It's quite odd. And then I'm sure many people also resonate, but I felt like a lack of trust. It was hard for me to trust that this was genuine. And I think to some extent I was proven wrong. Like, as I say, you know, clients have invested more in this process and have started to understand the necessity of this, but also there was a lot of performance. There was a lot of tokenism. There was a lot of black squares and empty solidarity statements. I don't know. I still feel very complicated about it. And running a business that basically relies on white people having empathy and interest in our lives is a little scary, because I'm like, I have no idea when they're going to get bored of this. I have no idea when it's no longer cool or interesting to do anti-racism work. Like, how long does this last? We had such an increase in demand and we had to meet that demand that my team really grew. But then, you know, what if next year nobody's into it anymore? You know, what do I do then? So relying on the fickleness of allies is a bit of a scary foundation for a business. Yeah, I just think it's been such a weird year, and I'm naturally a very optimistic person. So I do feel like things have shifted and it feels easier to have conversations about white supremacy or anti-blackness or decolonization in a way that I couldn't have had a year ago. So I think that's a silver lining, but overall exhausting and weird.
Yeah, I'm with you. Exhausting and weird, and definitely a fickle foundation. I find it very interesting that you put it that way. I totally agree. What about like on a personal level in terms of this work? What's that work been like for you? And I guess really what I'm asking is, has there been work for you in your personal life and in reconciling a lot of these different kinds of experiences or your own racial identity? If there's any sort of work on your personal journey?
Yeah, I would say personally, I think the greater visibility of people of color, especially queer people of color, has helped me feel more seen and more confident in my identity and my experience. And I think that has helped me sort of find, even though I'm the CEO, like I lacked confidence in my own abilities as a leader. And I think having Black folks taking up space and being seen, and, you know, sometimes again, it was tokenistic, but I think to some extent, the deeper conversations about social justice or, you know, BLM being represented, or yeah, sort of protests being represented on television, I think it just helped for me to humanize myself in a way that I wasn't really allowing for myself to do before. And yeah, you know, seeing other people gain the confidence to speak up for themselves and to hold people accountable when they harm them really allowed me to gain a lot of confidence and to stand up for myself in particular situations, and just sort of helped me grow, yeah, as a leader as well.
That's wonderful. I have to say, you probably already know this, but in case, you know, you don't know this, you're having that exact impact on other people. I guarantee it. And definitely for me, you are. I know that one example that I can think of is growing up, you know, I felt genderqueer for sure. I didn't necessarily feel like I fit into the binary sort of idea of gender, but I didn't know it was an option. I just didn't know it was an option. I thought like it just wasn't an option. So I kind of just figured, well, I feel this way and it's not really relevant what anybody else perceives me as, because I know what I feel like. It doesn't really change me on the inside, but also I didn't know it was an option. And, you know, in the last few years, the conversation around pronouns has really picked up traction, conversation about gender identity and queerness and all this stuff. And just so many conversations have gained traction. Mm-hmm. It's been quite the whirlwind of a few years. But I can definitely speak for myself and probably for a multitude of people that I appreciate being able to see someone at the forefront of work and change and actual impact and you know, leading a business, being a CEO, you know, writing, just having all of this impact. And then adding to that, hey, this person identifies in a way that is similar or resonates more with me than any other person. And that's genuinely appreciated. I think that you are having that impact. I just wanted to say
thank you.
Yeah, the people that you're talking about, you're basically those people too.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Here's a fun question for you. Okay, actually, now I've got two questions. One is actually not the first question that I had, but this is a question that one of my housemates tends to ask a lot, and I've decided to kind of just take it and run with it. You're the first person I'm asking this question to, by the way. If you were a flavor, and it could be any flavor, what would that flavor be?
Oof, that's such a hard question. A flavor. I would say maybe like salted caramel. Like, I feel like people see me as like, you know, I feel like and recognize this is partly due to like light skin privilege, but like, I feel like, you know, one of the biggest comments I always get about my presence or my speaking is how approachable and eloquent and well-spoken I am. And I think that helps to soften the blow of the stuff that I'm trying to say when I'm calling people out, you know, but they see me as this sort of kind of palatable Black person, but then they get the salt when they're not expecting it. So yeah, I would say maybe I'm a salted caramel.
I love it. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And also what you just shared, there's a lot to unpack there, but I'll go back to my other question. So my other question, what is present for you in your life at this time?
Gardening. I like gardening at the moment. That feels good and feels, you know, I think especially as I mentioned, just starting medication for ADHD and being able to focus on something and commit to something in ways that I haven't been able to before. So it's been nice to grow my own herbs and it just feels very grounding. And I'm not really an outdoorsy person, but that feels like an accessible way to go outdoors is to just go to the balcony and as I mentioned, sort of finally getting to a place where I feel like things are slowing down a bit and I can just take more time for myself, for, you know, introspection, and also take more time to support my team. And yeah, I was talking to my therapist the other day and she was saying that it sounds like a lot of my challenges stem from how much access people have to me and how, and therefore how much people expect and demand of me. And I feel like that's something I've been able to take control of over the past few months. So that, yeah, my goal was by summer to feel less of that, to feel less sort of pulled in all these directions or have all these expectations. And I think that still exists, but I've been able to change my mindset somewhat to, you know, so that I can determine for myself who gets to have me and who gets to have my opinion and my time and my labor and my intellectual property. And yeah, so that's kind of what's feeling present at the moment is just like that coming back into myself and yeah, just more time for rest.
Mm-hmm. I love it. That's beautiful. I'm wondering now, so one of the things that you're up to is obviously writing as well as other things. Have you always been this person? And of course, you know, you haven't always been this person. You have changed over time. But I mean, if you think back to the little girl that you used to be, what are some of the things that were very present then that are still very present now?
I would say the concept of leadership is something that has always been present, but the way that evolved has been very different. Like, I think, yeah, I was always told as a young person that, you know, I was destined to be a leader. I used to really want to be prime minister. I thought that was going to be my job. And that's always been something that has been not, I wouldn't say like forcefully pushed onto me, but, you know, I was often kind of, you know, the person doing all the work in the group project or, you know, volunteering to take the lead of something and, you know, or, you know, became a prefect in school and things like that. So that element of kind of leadership has always been there. But they think, yeah, over the past few years, like really understanding what that means and what kind of leader I want to be and how to stay true to my values in that and how to reckon with the power that I have, both in terms of privilege, but then also power that I've gained over time as a leader within my organization. But I just remember lots of conversations about that as a young person. And even when I came to Vancouver to go to UBC, I came on a scholarship called the International Leader of
Tomorrow. Of course you did.
So there was a lot of pressure that I would be a leader of tomorrow. And yeah, I think that's something that has always being with me, and I think along with a sense of justice. And, you know, I come from a very justice-oriented family. My one of my earliest memories is going to a protest with my grandma. And I think I kind of got lost a little bit in my adolescence of like what that meant. But overarchingly, that's always been a value that's been important to me.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now I want to ask you more about that, but I also would love to hear, and before I ask you this question, at any point, if you do feel like there's a different direction that you want to go in, please just say it. I'd love to know, so what does it mean to be a leader to you? What is leadership and what kind of leader are you?
I think I'm still figuring it out. Yeah, I think a leader is someone who sees potential in other people and helps them to hone their skills and gives them the tools that they need to express themselves creatively, professionally, emotionally. And yeah, I definitely wouldn't have said that a few years ago, but I think as my team has grown, I realized how exciting it is for me to, you know, have all these people who are connected over shared values and each has their own, you know, strength and skills, and they come to me with ideas. And my number one philosophy as a leader is trying to say yes to as many things as possible and, you know, not shutting people down, or at least helping people find a way where they can actualize an idea or dream they have. And so, yeah, I think I definitely had internalized stereotypes about leadership of a leader takes charge and a leader runs the show and makes all the decisions. There's obviously some element of responsibility there, but yeah, I think leadership is really about empathy and seeing potential in other people and giving them the tools they need to do what they want with their life.
Mm-hmm. I love it. That's beautiful. Yeah. I'm just sitting that with that for a moment. That is beautiful.
Thank you.
What do you do for fun? I know that people don't like this question, but what do you do for fun?
It varies. I mean, again, with ADHD, I'm doing one thing 1 minute and then I'm over it. But at the moment, I wouldn't say at the moment. I've actually been obsessed with this for 21 years, but it comes and goes. I love to play The Sims. That's my favorite game. So that's what I'm into. I have a secret Instagram account where I post like things that I create in The Sims, but
great.
I will not be revealing the username. I just love it because it's such a disconnect. It's like, it's so removed. You know, I also like to read like fantasy or YA. Like I love that kind of escapism where you're like in this other world. I like cooking. I don't do it as often as I would like because I think the thought of it is overwhelming. But when I'm actually doing it, I'm like, oh yeah, I actually really enjoy this. I guess in normal times, I like traveling too, but haven't done that in a while.
Yep. It's been a while for most of us. Definitely been a while. It will be a while. Hopefully not. Let's see here. If you were to ask some of the folks on your team what they appreciate or admire the most about you, what do you think they'd say?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would say they would probably say that I'm very transparent and open, like both with my personal experiences. You know, I like them to know me as a person. You know, I don't want to be kind of like an elusive leader who nobody knows like what's their story and stuff like that. You know, I think it's important for me to be human with them. I think also with the work as well, I try to be very transparent about decisions I'm making and why I'm making those decisions, what's coming up in the future so that people aren't surprised by how decisions are made and stuff like that. I would say they would also say that I'm fun, hopefully. We have a pretty casual environment. I like to make people laugh. And I think often they wonder, I mean, a lot of people wonder this, but wonder where I find the time to do all the things that I do, which is not a bad thing. I mean, sometimes it's a bad thing because I do also want to really encourage my team to rest and take care of their mental health and not overwork themselves. And I recognize I am not modeling that at the moment, but it's much better to be like that than to be one of those leaders who does nothing and expects people to do things on their behalf. So yeah, I would say they would probably say I work too hard.
That's awesome. So how do you manage to get so much stuff done?
Especially at the moment, as I say, with this new medication, it's kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time because it has a 12-hour sort of life cycle, or whatever you would call it. So yeah, I can literally sit at my computer for 12 hours and forget to eat, drink, go to the toilet, or do anything and get so much done, which is kind of scary, but also good to some extent. But even before I was on the medication, I think I always, not always, but I leaned into following my energy, which I think is definitely such a benefit of having the creative freedom that I have in my job. If I get a burst of energy or inspiration, I just do that thing at that moment. And then maybe the next day I don't do anything or I do less. But just kind of, yeah, following that inspiration, because I think what holds a lot of people back from their true potential, especially their sort of creative potential, is that, you know, we're not designed to work 9 to 5. We're not designed to work in cubicles and things like that. So probably most people could do the same amount of things I do if they had more creative freedom and flexibility and more control over their time. And not to say that people should do more. It's totally fine if people don't want to do anything. But I think that, yeah, there's a lot of folks who have a lot of ideas and you know, creative juices running inside them, but are constrained by capitalism and professional standards. But because I'm the leader, I get to, I mean, obviously I'm still at the whim of client to some extent, but yeah, I get to define my schedule and yeah, just kind of do things when I want, which I think has really helped.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we're designed to nap for sure. We're designed to nap at least 4 times a day. How do you extend that out to your team? Like, do they get to kind of, I guess, do you create the space for them to be able to go with their creative juices and really just kind of try and follow those different instincts within some sort of constraints?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I try to give them as much freedom as possible. Obviously, we do have meetings and a lot of client work, you know, happens at the sort of quote unquote usual times during the day, but there's no working hours. There's no schedule. People can work on their own time. People can work whenever they want. We try to do a maximum of 32 hours a week. So that's basically a 4-day work week. We have a lot of vacation time and days off, which I try to encourage people to take so that they get that rest. But yeah, I really encourage people to set their own schedules and define their working environment. I mean, things could be different if we do ever have an office space, for example, but at the moment, all of us are remote even before the pandemic. So yeah, things could potentially, but I hope not. But yeah, it's just better for everyone, really, if people have that freedom.
I agree. And I'm so glad that you're doing that. I think it's super important. Like for me, it really just always boils down to if you've got a group of people who are committed to executing on a certain vision or a plan, and their commitment extends out into the decisions that they make day to day, they hold themselves accountable to that commitment, then you can trust that they are going to execute and they are going to show up in the ways that are necessary. And so that eliminates the need for really kind of limiting people with their time and how they go about doing things. And it's just that I think this is the future. So I'm glad you're on board. It's the future of work.
So true. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much evidence that that works better, that people were not designed. I mean, fundamentally, we should not have to work to live in general. But I guess under the constraints of what we exist within, if we do have to do that, I think we should do that in a way that is least traumatizing to our bodies and minds. And, you know, in a way that is fits in naturally with the rest of our lives, as opposed to work being our central piece and everything else is supposed to fit around that. So yeah, I hope to create an environment where work is something people do when they can, but also in an ideal world, we would all just be, I don't know, living on a farm or something.
Yeah, exactly. In an ideal world. I love it. What are there any movies or TV shows or books that you're excited about lately?
Oh, yes. I'm a huge Marvel fan, so I'm watching The Falcon and the Winter Soldier at the moment, and then I'm going to watch WandaVision after. I know I'm a bit late on that. Other Marvel fans will be disappointed that I didn't watch it immediately, but I wanted to rewatch all 23 Marvel movies.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So that's what I was doing. So yeah, I watched all 23 Marvel movies in order. I really love Good Trouble. It's a spin-off of The Fosters, which was, I think, is on Netflix. Oh, nice. And it's so good. Like, it's actually, I would probably say, the best show I've ever watched, because it has this incredible ability to talk about like social justice issues in such a nuanced way, but also a very realistic way, not like in a tokenistic or cheesy way. And this show, I just finished watching the first 3 seasons, and you know, they started making the show in like 2017, 2018. So like kind of quote unquote before, you know, everybody talking about BLM or like using BLM as a prop. And they actually have Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of BLM, producing and acting in the show.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's actually really dope and like so underrated. Like not enough people know about it. So I hugely recommend that show.
Well, thanks for sharing. I had no idea. I mean, I love the Fosters. I didn't know there was a spinoff that's
Yeah. It's the spinoff is Callie and Mariana move to LA together and it's kind of like them and their lives.
What? That's amazing. Yeah. Now I have a show to watch. I've got a new show to watch. Although I just started watching, I think it's called Run the World, if I'm not mistaken. I started watching that yesterday and I think that's going to be my new favorite show as well. Beautiful, beautiful. I definitely have more questions and I feel like I could take you in any direction here, but I'd like to kind of give you the opportunity to talk about something that maybe you want to talk about in this moment.
Oh, what do I want to talk about? Yeah, I mean, I guess just going off of that conversation about like TV shows, can I go anywhere with
this? You can go anywhere.
Okay, well, I was just thinking like how I have a lot of clients kind of wondering how to navigate that sort of public part of this work, you know, and that's something I've been grappling with as well, is especially, again, last year, people would, you know, post on social media that they were going to be working with us as a way to, yeah, for clout, basically. And we had to kind of draw a line and even put it in our contracts that, you know, clients can't post publicly about their work with us until we say that they can. Mm. And another part of that is how a lot of the other shows that I watch have been bringing in storylines about police brutality and anti-blackness. But because it's happening in pretty much every single show that I watch, but it's also being done in a very surface level way, it actually feels more traumatizing. And it's made it really difficult to enjoy those shows or to switch off or to relax while watching them, because those conversations are happening at such a surface level that, yeah, it doesn't go deep enough for anybody to actually process anything, any of the characters to actually process anything. I don't know. That was just like something that's been on my mind, is like, I do really believe in the power of media and social media. And I believe that's what has created the how something like Black Lives Matter could grow so big, so quickly, could have global chapters. But at the same time, it's such a complicated and dangerous thing. So I guess that's just what's been on my mind lately.
Yeah, I feel you. I hear you. I personally think it, like, sometimes I'm a little concerned with like the amount of imagery and the sort of the way in which that narrative just keeps getting told in different ways, because I'm concerned that it's just perpetuating like this as being like the only facet of racial identity. Like this is the only thing that there is to talk about when you talk about a Black person, for example. Like this is it. It's all the oppression, the violence, the trauma, slavery, all that stuff. And there's nothing else going on. Mm-hmm. That's concerning, because I just think about, never mind, well, I guess adults as well, but children, if a child keeps seeing footage and imagery of, and say this child is Black, of other Black folk being oppressed and violence against them, this child is much far more likely to develop this idea or this narrative that that's what being Black means. That's the Black identity. It's being oppressed and violence. And it is part of the identity. However, I think it's equally important to make space for all the other parts of the identity, which have nothing to do with that. Like those are just very human identities. I'm with you. And I think that's why I've been leaning towards TV shows that show more of the other amazing, incredible parts that aren't necessarily centered around violence, because that's super important. So I feel you. I hear you. That makes sense. You should maybe try out Run the World. I'm 99% sure that's what it's called, but
I'm putting this on my list.
Yeah, it's like a Black cast version of Sex in the City, if you will.
Ooh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty good. Love that. Pretty good. Cool. Well, this has been an incredible conversation. I didn't even get to ask you about your queer identity. I guess we've got a little more time. Is that something you are open to sharing about?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Let's hear about that.
Just generally about my identity?
Well, I mean, I guess your journey with that.
Yeah. So I think I always felt like I was queer. Well, specifically relating to a poster of Rihanna in my friend's bedroom when I was 11. Then high school happened and there was expectations around, you know, having boyfriends and stuff. So I kind of almost, even though I had sort of come out to myself at around 11 or 12, I sort of went back into the closet, I guess, in high school. And then in moving to Vancouver, you know, the university is a chance to reinvent yourself and to, mm-hmm. you know, explore your identity. And so that's when I kind of came out for real. And I think the sort of my friend and family were accepting, but I felt like the challenges really were around the intersections of race and queerness and gender identity and just sort of the how most of the Black folks I knew were straight cisgender folks and most of the queer folks I knew were white. So I really felt like this kind of, as you said before, like I felt like this was not for me, like this wasn't an option. And like I was like, well, yeah, no, that's fine. I'll just accept that that's not something that's available to me. Like I remember one of my best friends coming out in grade 9 and I was just like, yeah, that's great for her, but like that's not yeah, she's white and that's just not available to me. And I never really sort of unpacked it. I just had sort of internalized this idea, I guess, through sort of lack of role models, of lack of representation. And I think over-representation of straight mm-hmm. Black, I felt there was over-representation also of like, what's the word, like monoracial couples too. Like there weren't very many mixed race couples being portrayed in the media. Mm-hmm. So on top of that, I was kind of like, well, I exist as a result of interracial relationships. And that's sort of something that even then, like in the 90s, was still a little bit taboo. And it was just like, okay, well, you know, I guess I just sort of exist as this like solo body for the rest of my life kind of thing. And especially, yeah, a lot of TV shows would portray like a Black couple and they would be just very heterosexual, whereas like maybe a white couple, even if they were straight, would still have more, I don't know, fluidity mm-hmm. to them, or yep. like there would just be less stringency around their like gendered expectations, even if they were portrayed as a heterosexual couple. So I think that added to it as well. And then it really took me a long while to find my sense of self, you know, coming into the queer community. Then there's just a whole nother layer of social norms and expectations that you then have to conform to. Mm-hmm. And again, with ADHD, you know, a lot of the research also suggests that a lot of folks with ADHD tend to, or neurodivergent folks in general, tend to sort of try to mimic other people around them or to conform to the group that they're in, which I didn't realize until I look back. I definitely have done that so many times, sort of mimicking the people around me to try to conform, to try to copy their, you know, mannerisms or their ways of being or their social norms. And so very quickly, I found myself sort of losing my sense of identity, trying to, you know, cut my hair short and straighten my hair and wear plaid and like, you know, do all of these things that I thought queer people were supposed to do. Mm. I would say really only since graduating, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, did I really sort of come into myself and understand the beauty of you can be femme and queer and you can be a mixture or you can be androgynous or you can be fluid in your presentation. And, you know, I think it took me a really long time to understand that and to move away from the stereotypes and the pressure I felt to go from conforming to straightness to then conforming to homonormativity. And I think BLM played a huge role in that because for me, that was the first sort of intersectional space that I ever entered, you know, a space that really valued not only Black life, but like Black, queer and trans life. And, you know, seeing people like Patrice Cullors and the founders of BLM being Black queer women really helped me to take ownership of my identity and to be confident being femme and to be confident. There is an element of straight passing privilege, but that can also mean invisibility mm-hmm. And erasure. So it took a while to sort of come to terms with that, but now.
Now you have. That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I just want to say there's nothing you've said, and that ties right into you can be exactly who you are. That's the thought that came up for me. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the irony of it, is that we already are who we are. like everything else is just layered on top of it. But it, who we are is already there. That's who we can be. And that's a really beautiful thing to finally come to terms with and really embody. These kinds of conversations are just so impactful, in my opinion, because it really helps to encourage other people to make that space for themselves, within themselves. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for sharing that. And thank you for being who you are and all the work that you're up to, of course, and for coming on to the show today. Very appreciative of that. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap this up with?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me. This was such a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate your very good question asker. So thank you.
That's great. I'm so glad. I'm going to put that down in my list of skills. I'm a good question asker. Everyone. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you, and wishing you a wonderful week ahead. And that was another episode here at the Almas Podcast. I'm your host, Gabriella Love, of course. What an incredible human being Cicely Blaine is. Truly, what a great leader. The thing that stood out to me most was the leadership that they embody, the kind of leadership that they embody. It was a very empowering conversation. I hope you enjoyed that. Shout out to Bacow Consulting, of course, their team, Cicely Blaine's team, all of the folks there. I'm sure they are doing amazing, amazing work. If you'd like to check them out, do have a look at the description. All of the information is there. Thanks again for tuning in. And of course, if you have any questions, comments, feel free to reach out. And in the interim, share this episode far and wide. Share it with those you think might benefit from this conversation. And we'll catch you next time.